I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Food writer and cookbook author Mark Bittman explores in his new book, Animal Vegetable Junk, how the food we eat has shaped human history from our hunter-gatherer ancestors to big food, the industrial agribusinesses that control much of what we eat today. In America, we get more than half of our calories from highly processed foods, something we export to much of the rest of the world. The problem is the American diet is unsustainable. It's bad for our health, and it's bad for the planet. The COVID pandemic has also revealed a deep divide in our food supply system, with long lines at food pantries and the reality, if you've been paying attention, that the essential workers who are part of the food chain are underpaid, overworked, and overlooked. Mark Bittman joins us to talk about how to create a food system that supports health, well-being, and justice, and tastes good, too. He's written 30 books, including the How to Cook Everything series. He's on the faculty at Columbia University. He's also editor of the Bittman Project. And Mark Bittman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be here. And really, your summary, we could almost stop there. And I guess I've done
we have an hour
where we kind of did, but you nailed it.
We have an hour to fill. And you have written a lot of things in this book, and I want to get to about 20% of them. But let me begin with a more personal question. How has your eating, your cooking, whatever you've been doing food-wise, how has that changed during the pandemic over this last year? Or has it?
Well, I'm cooking more, like most people, I think. And I think probably for the first time in my life, I've gotten sick of it.
You got sick of cooking, really?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are nights that my partner and I look at each other and say, suppose we skip dinner. And it happens. But I'm lucky. I have access to great ingredients. And, you know, I have a decent kitchen. And obviously, I know how to cook. So it hasn't been really a problem. And actually, there's been a lot of opportunity to try things that I've wanted to try and work on things that I've been meaning to work on and so on. So all in all, from a cooking perspective, it's been, I'd say, an A.
An A. Oh, good for you.
Yeah, I mean,
very lucky.
Good. Yeah, I am.
Very lucky. I've had maybe moments of A, mostly have C minus, but that's something for a different discussion. But I do think, and I mentioned this in my introduction, that the pandemic has really forced us to look at our country, whether it's probably people like you and me who get to work from home and keep our jobs, and then we see so much of the rest of the country that has either lost income or lost jobs. They're food insecure. They're in lines at food pantries. Do you think this is a moment when we can do some really serious self-reflection?
I mean, I hope so. Sometimes I despair because somehow food is just left out of the conversation, and I don't understand it. And I felt this way for a long time. I'll try not to go too deeply into this, but I sometimes see articles that talk about the different crises that face us as a country, and food and agriculture just are left out. And yet, COVID killed 300,000 people last year. It'll kill maybe nearly that many this year, or maybe two-thirds that many. Diet-related chronic diseases generally are responsible for more than 1 million deaths a year in the United States, and no one seems to consider that a crisis. And not only that, many of the people who died from COVID, who are dying from COVID, have diet-related chronic diseases that complicate, that make them more susceptible to complications and death of from COVID. So this is like, I almost don't know what to say, because I don't want to, you know, downplay COVID or downplay the climate crisis or downplay anything else, but this is one of our leading problems, is how we do agriculture, how we eat, the effect that has on the environment and of all of our health. And as you said in the intro, we export this kind of food. We export the American way of eating at expense to the rest of the world. And yet it's not on anyone's, well, not no one's, but it's not on Joe Biden, for example's list of the top five things to address.
Well, it's in part why you are here. But let me ask with a really basic question, and I think you do include this in your book, which is, you know, what is food for? I mean, what is food really? What is it supposed to do besides, you know, keep us alive? But what is it supposed to do? Maybe that is what it's supposed to do.
Right. Well, it's certainly supposed to, I did this a few years ago. It's an interesting exercise. You just play with a dictionary for 5 minutes and you look up food and it says it's a substance that is meant to nourish. But it doesn't tell you anything until you look up nourish. And when you look up nourish, it says promotes health. So food is supposed to promote health. So let's say that's what food is for. It's a thing that's supposed to promote health. It keeps us alive. It's one of the most, obviously, three or four most essential things there is. But it's also supposed to keep us alive in good fashion. It's supposed to keep us healthy. And as you said in the introduction, I mean, I was serious when I said you nailed it. More than half of the food that is produced in the United States today is ultra-processed food. And most ultra-processed food runs counter to promoting health. It actually promotes what someone used to call ILF, the opposite of health. It promotes
ILF.
Disease. Yeah, I mean, it promotes disease. It promotes metabolic syndrome. It promotes obesity. It promotes cancers and diabetes and so on down the line. And that's not what food is for. And the other thing, the other question is sort of equally deep, is we don't ask what food is for in the sense that if we said it's to nourish as many people as possible while inflicting minimal damage on the environment. Let's just stop there. We could talk about many other things, but
sure.
If we just stop there, we don't even accomplish that bare minimum, because what we know food is for, just like what we know most things in this country are for, is to generate profits. That's how the system is set up. It's not to set up to nourish eaters as well as possible. It's set up to generate profits for the corporations who run it as much as possible. That's a fundamental problem. So we can talk about solutions, long-term,
sure,
and short-term, and I'm sure we will.
And we will. I do want to get to solutions, but I want to just quote from your book, frankly, to underscore what you just said. You write, the food industry became the junk food industry. 60% of the calories we eat are in ultra-processed food. Sugar, salt, and fat were added to just about every processed food as soups, sodas, crackers, pizza, pastries, bread, chips, yogurts, chicken fingers, and thousands of others were engineered for maximum appeal. You go on to say the last quarter of the century, the number of calories consumed in snacks doubled while calories eaten at dinner decreased by one third. So how did ultra-processed food, how did that take over our diet?
Well, it's a long story. And part of it is that it's still happening. And Michael Moss's new book, Hooked, talks about how food companies are engineering food so that it becomes not only irresistible, but literally addictive. So the process is ongoing. But it really began with the growing of food for cash, growing of crops for cash, food as a commodity as opposed to food as something that would nourish the farmer could sell locally to give to his family or her family, sell locally, trade locally, sell regionally, and so on. Instead, what happened was farms grew bigger, farmers were encouraged to use hybridized seeds, tractors, chemicals, and so on, with the goal of raising a maximum amount of one or maybe two crops. Most often in the 20th century, first wheat and then corn and now corn and soybeans, to sell those crops. And this is part of a sort of general global trend around the economy in general, which is that the idea of the World Bank, the IMF, the sort of people who tell countries how to run themselves, the idea is that each country, each region is supposed to produce what they produce best, whether it's cotton or cars or wheat or soybeans or corn or whatever. and then sell that on the global market to get income to buy the things from other places that produce their best stuff, and to discourage local production, especially farming, regional trade, and so on. And so the net effect of that has been that farmers, first in the United States and then elsewhere around the world, starting in Europe after World War II, starting then continuing in Asia, Africa, Latin America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, this kind of discouraging of farming for yourself, farming for your region, and encouragement of buy the food you need, produce what you produce best, be on the global market. This, of course, we saw some problems with this at the beginning of COVID, and we see problems with this all the time.
But there are, what, 6-8 billion people in the world. I mean, could we feed the world? Could the world feed itself by relying on, you know, local farms that are producing local products and selling that to people locally? Would that work?
Well, two-thirds of the world still does that. So the answer is probably yes. But the resources over the last 100, 150 years have all been poured into industrial agriculture, profit-making agriculture, commodity agriculture, whatever you want to call it. All of the 90%, 95% of the resources of USDA and other funding agencies have been put into increasing yield, producing as much as possible on one piece of land of one crop at a time, ignoring consequences to the environment, virtually ignoring consequences to human health. You know, I can't say to you 100 years from now we're all going to be growing our own food. I think that's really unlikely. I think that the fantasy is to think that the status quo can remain because, as you said, and as I've said many times, it's not sustainable. So we need to move towards a better system. I can't tell you what that better system will look like any more than anyone can say what a better system of transportation will look like or work or anything. But it will look different, and I can say how we can start to move in that direction.
We're almost up on a break here. One thing, and this is sort of about the monoculture, I guess, or the monoculture of agriculture, which is that nature likes chaos. But when you look at those neat rows of corn, as far as the eye can see, that's kind of not what nature intended, right, Mark Bittman?
Yep. I mean, if you look at some old-fashioned, what's great is that if you go to places where they still do traditional agriculture and they take you to where they're growing, you say, where's the farm? Because you're standing in the middle of a forest. It's just that there's food growing all around you. It's really an amazing thing.
Well, let's take that short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with our guest. Mark Bittman is a food writer. He's a cookbook author, and he's got a new book. It's called Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The COVID crisis, the climate crisis have revealed big problems in our global food system. And again, joining us on Radio Times is Mark Bittman. He's got a new book, Animal Vegetable Junk. It traces our history of food production from agriculture to big ag. It describes the dangers of highly processed food, and it offers, frankly, a recipe for a more sustainable, healthy, and just diet, which we will get to. Mark, let me go from vegetables, from growing corn, to something called CAFOs. These are concentrated animal feed operations. You have a description of your book of a hog farm. I'm assuming we're talking about factory farms. Is that what a CAFO is?
Yeah, I've started to say factory farms because who needs the acronym and who needs the explanation? And everybody knows what a factory farm means or has some image in their head of what a factory farm means. So, yes.
All right, I will hopefully people aren't eating when I read this, but each hog CAFO, as you describe, generates on average waste equivalent to that of a town of around 10,000 people. This manure is stored in massive lagoons, which occasionally flood, poisoning the surrounding land and water. Sludge from the lagoons is routinely pumped into the air, producing a disease-causing chemical fog for miles around, and you go on from there. I mean, that's how we get most of our animal products, correct?
Yep, and it's not pretty. You know, the occasional video that makes the rounds showing some angry or upset or whatever, otherwise malbehaving worker literally torturing or abusing an animal just gets painted as the bad apple, and that the system is fine because that's getting exposed and that egregious offense is being dealt with. But the fact is there's almost no transparency in how we raise animals. And if there were, one could imagine there being webcams in any in every animal processing facility. If there were those kinds of things, our consumption of animal products would plummet because no one could possibly stomach what goes on in many of these factory farms. On a routine, I'm not talking about, it's all abusive, but I'm not talking about the isolated incident of some worker doing something weird. I'm talking about the daily routine of these factory farms is one of the most disgusting things that happens on this planet.
Mm. And we kind of hide it away. I mean, obviously out in more rural parts, so for most of us, we don't get to see that. And for the workers who work there, is it also disgusting?
It's bad for the workers who work there, although the workers in the food industry who suffer the most are probably slaughterhouse workers, so it's a little bit different. And a lot of these factory farms work with minimal amounts of labor. What's really, I mean, it's hard to say this is worse than that or that is worse than this, but
sure.
But something I'd like to point out is that those farms are usually in rural areas that are poor rural areas and often rural areas dominated by people of color. So there's this kind of environmental racism taking place where the people who suffer the biggest consequences of that kind of farming are the people who live near those farms and can't afford to leave. Yeah. And those farms do produce not only environment damaging, water damaging, air harming, etc., chemicals, but carcinogenic chemicals. So people literally get sick from living near these factory farms, and our regulations are either inadequate or not adequately enforced to deal with that.
Here's a question from Robert related to what we're talking about. He says, negative advertising is used a lot in political campaigns. Why don't we see plant-based meat companies using the same tactic to raise public awareness to show people how bad factory farming is for the environment? What do you think about that, Mark?
Well, I think that's a good idea. I don't think the answer is for-profit plant-based meat companies advertising against factory farming. But I do think the answer is some kind of regulation that says, let's make it be known how these farms really, how these factories, because they're really not farms in any sense of the word, how these factories really operate.
Where do you stand on, I guess it's called cell-based meat or fake meat? What are your thoughts about that? I mean, in certain ways, you're not killing an actual animal, but what are you eating if you eat this stuff? I don't happen to like the taste of it. It just, I don't know. It's not my thing. But anyway, right. I'm just curious about how you feel about it.
Well, I don't think you've tasted cell-based meat. You've tasted plant burgers, basically.
So yeah, probably.
New generation of plant burgers that involves a slightly higher form of technology than a Gardein burger or whatever. But I agree. I don't think they're that great. I think, you know, I can give you a recipe for a bean burger or a grain burger that's really, really good and is not processed to death and is not super expensive. And I think that's a great alternative to meat. The cell-based stuff is a lab-grown meat is a little bit down the road, and I think the jury's out. I mean, maybe it'll be amazing, but I don't think that that's a near future, a short-term answer. I think a short-term answer is somehow regulating factory farms so that we're basically forced to produce less meat and then eat less meat.
Do you see, though, a role for, I guess, technology in the broadest sense of the word in our food supply system? I mean, you know, on the one hand, I mean, I guess we sort of feed the world, but not obviously very inequitably. But I'm thinking about things like GMOs. Is there a place for that in food production to try to figure out how to get more and better food to more of the planet?
I mean, we would like to feed the world. We, that is big food, would like to feed the world because it's profit. The more food they sell, the more money they make. But most of the world is quite capable of feeding itself. And I think it's important to remember that. We're not responsible for feeding other people. That's a sort of myth that we've adopted, but it doesn't really make any sense. Technology, you know, the plow is technology. The tractor
sure.
is certainly technology. Hybridized seeds are technologies. Genetically engineered seeds have potential. Genetic engineering has the potential to do good, but so far all it's done is increase the use of pesticides. And by the way, increase the incidence of cancers related to pesticides. So I don't think anyone's going to argue, except for the producers, that that's a good thing.
Here's an email from Thomas. He said, what do you mean, this is to you, Mark, what do you mean when you say industrial agriculture is unsustainable? What factors will make it incapable of continuing to produce food 10 to 50 years from now?
I mean, putting aside the public health crisis that it's causing, which more Americans die from diet-related disease every year, three times as many at least die from diet-related disease every year than did from COVID in 2020. So putting that aside, loss of topsoil, lack of resources for making chemical fertilizer, cancers resulting from the use of pesticides, I could go on.
Okay, that's a bit of a flavor there. Let me just quickly reintroduce you again. Mark Bittman is our guest on Radio Times. Today we're talking about his new book, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. So what would a healthy diet for everybody, what would that look like?
Yeah, I mean, the diet part in a way isn't that challenging. It's how to produce the food that and how to produce the society that gets us to eat that way. But your question is, what's the diet look like? And
right.
the diet looks like way less junk food, approaching zero, way fewer animal products. Lancet recommends a reduction of 90% in countries like ours, which is, you know, a lot.
It is.
But 50% would make a big difference. Even 30% would make a big difference. And way more plants that are closer in to their natural form. So fruits, vegetables, obviously, legumes, whole grains, nuts, seeds, healthy oils. I mean, everybody kind of, when you say the words good diet, I think most people know what you're talking about. Really, the question is, how do you get there?
Right. And we are a country that has grown up largely, not everybody, but largely on, you know, convenience foods or highly processed foods. That stuff starts really early. And I wonder whether we sort of get a taste for, what is it, sugar, salt and fat. I mean, those are just such stimulating things to have to savor in our mouths.
We do get a taste for it. Our taste buds, obviously, we do have natural preferences, but those preferences can be altered, changed, directed. And what we've done, and this is mostly since World War II, is what we've done is allow the marketers of junk food, of ultra-processed food, to target little kids. And little kids don't know the difference between right and wrong or truth and lies. And they are taught, as you and I were taught, that Coca-Cola is the most fun beverage to drink and McDonald's is the best place to go eat and Tony the Tiger is our closest buddy and so on down the line. And we learn that stuff before we're four. And you grow up having to try to shed the lies that you were told by Big Food when you were young. And we all know, every single person listening to this knows how difficult it is to change your food preferences. We've all tried. We've probably all succeeded to some extent and failed to some extent. But we're all living lives where we battle the difference between what we were brought up on and what we were told as children and what we know to be true now. We know what a good diet is. It's a question of how we can get to that place individually. And really, the only way we can as individuals is to address it as a society.
Hmm. Yeah, as you were talking, I'm thinking that there are times when I drive by a McDonald's and I literally salivate for a fish sandwich, which, you know, is a million calories. And whenever I have one, I feel terrible after it's over. My mouth is like just filled with grease. But damn, if I don't
that
start salivating.
Isn't that something that we crave foods and we have this experience of eating them and feeling bad afterwards and yet one day later, one week later, at the most, we'll crave them again.
I mean, is that an addiction? Should we treat it like an addiction?
Well, Michael Moss and others, I mentioned Moss before, but we'll say yes, it is an addiction. It's as close to an addiction as you can get without being like a cigarette, coffee, heroin kind of addiction. But it's an addiction in the sense that you want to routinely come back to it. It gives you a kind of reward. You are a little bit obsessed. I mean, all the things that make it addiction, except for withdrawal. And with sugar, there are even withdrawal symptoms. So yeah, it's addictive. And let's not forget that other addictive substances like caffeine, to which, I mean, not all of us are addicted, but most of us are addicted, like caffeine is put into processed foods to make them more addictive. So, you know, let's not forget that.
Well, and I think the other part of it is that it's everywhere. I mean, whether you're driving around and you're seeing fast food franchises everywhere, or you just go into the supermarket, the shelves are just packed with this stuff.
Well, again, and I think we may get into access and affordability here, because if 60% of the food in the United States is ultra-processed, that means that 60% of the calories that are presented to us are in the form of junk food. Someone has to eat those calories. So whether it's you craving your fish sandwich or me craving my pizza or whatever, and us satisfying, so easy to satisfy those desires, all of us are eating more or less than 60% of our calories in the form of ultra-processed food, but on average, that's what we're all eating. So we need to change that proportion in order to change our collective diet. Individuals can have some control over this, and obviously people with more money and more time have more control than people with less money and less time, and that's not fair. But as a society, we don't really have control over this. 60% is more or less fixed. We are going to eat that this year. So how do we change that?
Well, and that gets to the discussion about food deserts. You call it food apartheid. The fact that in a lot of especially low-income neighborhoods, you've got many more fast food franchises or stores that sell this ultra-processed food compared to an actual supermarket that might have some fresh fruits and veggies.
Well, supermarkets are not in principle racist. They go where the money is. So it's really a question of where's the money. If I give you some money, you will find food. If you don't have any money, your chances of finding food are much, much slimmer. So it's not that there are geographical areas that somehow are verboten to supermarkets. It's that supermarkets want to go where they can make the most money, and they make the most money where there are the most people with money. It's pretty much as simple as that.
So diet and income, I mean, that there's a correlation between the two.
I mean, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's such a shame that food isn't addressed more frequently in these kinds of, not these kinds of conversations, but in higher level policy conversations, because you can't really address all of these food issues without addressing income and income inequality, because people need to be able to afford good food in order to, we have to make it available, we have to make it accessible, and we have to make it affordable. Those three things have to happen together. So we have to change production, we have to change distribution, but we also have to change how people buy food and whether they're able to afford better food. So that's either subsidizing the food so that less money can buy higher quality food, or giving people more money, or making sure that people have more money so that everybody can afford to buy what we know to be better, healthier food.
We're almost up in a break here, but as you're talking, it reminds you a little bit of what First Lady Michelle Obama talked about for 8 years. Did she make a dent, do you think?
I mean, I think she made a dent in the public relations arena. I think more people talked about things, but I think, you know, I don't want to be too openly critical of the Obama administration in general, but I think that the first couple of years, President Obama had some opportunities to make some changes that he didn't take advantage of. And I also think, as Bill Clinton made the mistake of putting his spouse in charge of changing health care, Obama made the mistake of putting his spouse in charge of changing food. That's not exactly a cabinet-level position. I mean, with all respect to those women, it's not really an empowered position.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Again, that's Mark Bittman. He writes about food, he's written cookbooks, and he's got a new book. It's called Animal Vegetable Junk. And you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Mark Bittman about his new book, Animal Vegetable Junk. He writes that the top five meat and dairy companies combined to produce more emissions than ExxonMobil. His book tracks the history of what humans have eaten through the ages, from the invention of agriculture to today's ultra-processed foods, where Americans get something like 60% of our daily calories. And he says there is a way to feed the world that's healthy, sustainable, and more just. And again, you can join us radiotimes@whyy.org. Here's a question from Joe. Mark, he says, can the guest comment on the correlation between federal dietary guidelines and the rise in obesity? The dietary guidelines are nutritionally poor and were created to benefit certain food companies. Can you speak to that?
I mean, Joe answers his own question.
But, right, exactly. But you go into that, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's gotten better. I mean, if we were to follow the dietary guidelines, our diets would be improved. But the USDA has, which is the agency largely responsible for issuing the dietary guidelines, has a problem, which is that it has a dual mission. And its primary mission is to promote American agriculture. And it's secondary mission is to promote healthy eating. And you can't do promotion of American agriculture when it's industrial agriculture and promote healthy eating at the same time. So they're in a bit of a bind. They don't differentiate among they don't distinguish between healthy carbohydrates, for example, and not healthy carbohydrates. They don't make things as simple as they could for people to actually follow the guidelines. But again, we come back to this issue of supply, which is that it's not, most people know what a healthy diet is. They don't need this advice from USDA. They need access to good, healthy food. And if most of the food out in the market is not that, what are you supposed to do? I mean, really, what are people supposed to do?
Well, we have a new Secretary of Agriculture who was an old Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack.
Vilsack the second,
right. Well, he is back, tapped by Biden to be the Secretary of Agriculture. I mean, I think you interviewed him recently. Do I have that right, Mark?
No, I mean, I wrote a piece about USDA, and I dealt with a spokesman from there who was a great guy and had Vilsack's ear, but not directly, no.
So what do you make of that, that him being tapped to do this? And is he the guy to make the changes in how we distribute and talk about and grow food that speaks to what we've been talking about?
I mean, I think in 6 months we can answer that question really, really well. I think he's being guided by the administration, and I think the administration is setting a tone that I'm quite happy about. What's going to happen with the filibuster? What kind of legislation is going to be proposed? How far down the list is ag? Is it going to be part of this infrastructure, the new maybe $3 trillion package? How much of that is sort of Green New Deal material and so on? We need to answer those questions. I don't think Vilsack is setting the tone particularly of what's going to happen. I really think Biden and his staff are. We just don't know yet. I don't want to badmouth the guy. He did a terrible job during the Obama administration, but people change, and he can change too. I think Biden considered this carefully. Let's pretend to be optimistic for a little while.
I can pretend for a little while. It's harder. The long term is harder. You also say, well, let's change the name of the department to the Department of Food and Well-Being. You know, I don't know if branding can change the mission, but an interesting way to look at that. Let me read a couple of more comments we have here. Oh, here's from Sue. If the government was to effect positive change, what one piece of legislation would you pass to bring us a better food system in America?
Well, you know, the one piece of legislation thing is not a, it's not fair because I could say let's abolish factory farms or let's abolish monoculture, and that's so not going to happen that it's pointless. So if you'll indulge me for a minute, I'd like to say three or four things that I think could actually happen during this administration if things go well. And those things are eliminating the routine use of antibiotics in the production of animals. I'm not going to go into any detail on this, but antibiotic use is rampant and it has a bunch of problems and it could easily be stopped. Enforcing regulations on pesticides and doing new regulations on carcinogenic pesticides, that would be really important. Some kind of transparency and enforcing of existing regulations and new regulations around factory farms, which we've discussed. Some limits on marketing junk food to children, because as long as we raise children who have the kind of issues that you and I talked about a few minutes ago, we're going to have adults who have the kind of issues that you and I have. And some kind of way of figuring out how to get new farmers onto the land, people who want to steward the land, who want to farm well, who want to produce good food, and so on. I think, what was that, five things? Those are all doable. They're all really big. They're not panaceas. They're not fantasies. They're not crazy. But we'd have to work really hard to get even that stuff done.
Is it a fantasy to think about treating some of this ultra processed food like tobacco, especially when the advertising is aimed at children?
Well, the soda tax is a bit of a start for that, and yay Philly. I think I wrote that piece a few years ago, yay Philly for instituting a soda tax, and yay Berkeley for being the first city in the country to do that. And that's a start. And there are countries around the world that tax not only soda, but junk food. It's a stretch here. It's really a stretch to get that done. Certainly, I think it's a good idea. Can I see it happening in the next 5 years? No, in the next 10 or 20, maybe.
And sodas, I mean, sugary sodas, I forget how much sugar is in a 12-ounce bottle, but it is mind-boggling.
Yeah, 10 teaspoons, more or less. I mean, it's 100% of its calories from sugar. And you could say, given that the dietary guidelines, back to them, recommend that we get 10% of our calories from sugar every day. Most experts would say 5% is a better number. You could say that we don't want to have any foods that get 100% of their calories from sugar. You got to figure out a way to reduce the sugar in those drinks, aside from putting fake sugar in there. But, you know, I'm trying to be realistic here. I have fantasies too, but I just would like to get some of this stuff done that will set us on the road toward improving things and show us that improving things is actually possible. There's been so little encouraging in the world of food that you know, it'd just be nice to get some legislation on the books that moved us towards making things better.
Here's a question from David. He says, about 10 years ago, there was a big push by a lot of major food companies to collectively cut the amount of salt they put in their foods. Did anything ever come of this? Mark, do you know the answer to that?
I mean, still the biggest source of salt for Americans is ultra-processed food. It's not the salt shaker. So to the extent that salt is a problem in high blood pressure, and that's research that's 100 years old and seems to be holding, most of the sodium, it's not just salt, I mean, it's sodium in any form that we get comes from ultra-processed food. Not that if we cook ourselves, if we add salt to food that we cook ourselves, we are in very little danger of eating enough salt to affect our blood pressure. If we eat more highly processed foods, we are still in danger of doing that. Maybe they've cut back a little bit, but everything that Big Food promises to do is a form of, I should come up with a better term than greenwashing, but it's a form of public relations that says we're going to do things better, and then they do the minimum they can so that they can claim to do things better while changing their food as little as possible.
Do we then eat more ultra-processed food at home than we would out and about eating out in restaurants or fast food restaurants?
Well, you know, certainly we do in lockdown. Takeout food is often ultra-processed. Obviously, fast food from big corporations is ultra-processed food. And I'm sure many people are eating increased amounts of frozen food and pre-prepared food, and that's all ultra-processed food. You know, anything that's got a label with 20 ingredients on it, you just don't want to go anywhere near that.
Here's a question from Anne. She says, it sounds like your guest is saying that the problem with our food system is capitalism. Is that correct?
Yay, Anne.
Right, the bells are going off for you, Anne.
You know, that's why if someone says, what's the one thing you would do? I would be like, let's look at our economic system. But, you know, it's worth it to talk about these things. It really is. And, you know, Anne wouldn't have had the nerve to ask that question 10 years ago, and I wouldn't have had the nerve to say, yes, that's exactly the problem. But so things are changing in a way. We can talk about things differently. We can say we need to address the economic system. We can say land reform is an issue. We can say reparations to the descendants of slaves who were driven off their land, who were our best agriculturalists. We can candidly say that that's an issue. And 5-10 years ago, those things were difficult to say in forums like this.
But what do we do about it? I mean, we are a capitalist country. I don't, you know, Bernie Sanders and, you know, Andrea Cortez, I mean, those people aside, I just feel like we're still locked into this very capitalist point of view, whether it's about food or anything else.
Right, but things do change. Things do change. There was a safety net. You know, many people called that creeping socialism. There are different ways of doing things. There are ways of reining in corporate power. Let's start with that. We're not, you know, this is not Russia in 1917. We're not going to have that kind of situation, and it's silly to compare it to that. But we can mitigate the effects of capitalism, and we can move towards something that's, to use the words of old George Bush, kinder and gentler.
Here's an email from Nathan asking a kind of opposite question from Anne, saying, isn't it disingenuous to simply blame capitalism? Increasing income is a very human trait. How would food be produced if everyone wasn't earning a living?
I mean, I don't know where to start with that, because the assumption that earning more income is a human trait, I would take issue with that. Altruism is also a human trait. So Can we learn to work together as a society? We know more about ourselves, about other animals, about the earth, about everything. We know more than we ever have in history. We can make decisions better than we ever could before. Why can't we make decisions that benefit more people rather than decisions that benefit fewer people? I mean, I just take issue with the whole self-interest.
I mean, it's so interesting because we're also learning, you know, about mask wearing, which is, yes, you protect yourself, but you also are protecting other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, this seems like a very basic lesson that we are struggling to learn about, that we are a big country, but we are connected to each other.
Well, we are a big human race and we are connected to each other. And you're right. We're fighting about this. We are literally fighting about whether we want to protect each other or not. And, you know, I choose to be on the side of people who think that we're a big family. And I believe that we're in the majority. And I believe that we're going to make a difference around that. That's how I choose to live my life.
Here's a tweet from Mike. He says, how do we break the grasp of the huge processed food industry on farming and food production, who make huge contributions to politicians, and push them to a more healthy and sustainable food system? That wasn't on your list, Mark, of, you know, what we should do. But do you think, you know, campaign contributions as it relates to food production, that's something we should take a look at? Well, it looks like we lost contact with our guest, Mark Bittman, at the very end of today's show. That's too bad. Let me just recap what we talked about during the hour. He is a food writer. He's a cookbook author, and he explores in his brand new book, it's called Animal Vegetable Junk, how the food we eat has shaped human history from those early days of our hunter-gatherer ancestors to today's big food. That's the industrial agribusinesses that control so much of what we eat today. In fact, in America, we get something like 60% of our calories from highly processed foods. And this is something that we have exported to much of the rest of the world. As it turns out, the problem is the American diet is unsustainable. It's bad for our health, and it is also bad for the planet. We also talked about the fact that the COVID pandemic has revealed a deep divide in our food supply system. We've got long lines at food pantries, and we are learning that the essential workers who are part of the food chain are underpaid, they're overworked, and they're frankly overlooked. And Mark Bittman talked to us about how to create a food system that supports health, well-being, and justice, and tastes good too. In fact, he's written something like 30 books, including the How to Cook Everything series. He's also on the faculty at Columbia University, and he's the editor of the Bittman Project. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be imagining life after COVID. We'll be talking about a coronavirus passport, also how to handle the anxiety and, frankly, the uncertainty of returning to a pre-pandemic life, whatever that is. But I do hope that you can join us. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.